You can start a fire with damp tinder in the middle of a blizzard, I said, feeling an obscure need to defend him. I didn't see any Tsingani in the heart of the Skaldic wilderness, prince of travellers. We're not that stupid, Hyacinth laughed, and wandered off to watch the sailors at work, already taking on a rolling seaman's gait. I watched him sourly, left to tend to the heaving castellene. There is something innately pitiful about a man in vambraces spewing up his breakfast. It was Raus's plan to sail due west, running ahead of the wind that blows through the straits. If we got a good enough lead, he reckoned, we might outrun Elder Brother's Reach, gaining the open sea and rounding the southern tip of Alba. It was a good plan, and from what I understood, we took a good run at it. A full half day we sailed, until we were well and truly betwixt shores, neither visible, not Terdange that we had left, nor Alba that we sought. The weather held clear, and the wind blew true. As we headed west, nothing lay before us but open sea, that made my blood run cold with its endless horizon, and made the sailors sing. Truly they are a different breed, seafarers. I fixed my inner compass by the points around me, even in direst straits, knowing where I was. It is different for them. The unknown, the empty vastness of the sea, beckons with a lure I can but imagine. Outermost west, the Tsingani had called the far shores of Kushith. I understood then that it was only the place where the outermost west began, for the sea stretched endlessly, onward and onward, toward where the sun dies each night. Outermost west is beyond our ken. It is there, somewhere, the priests say, that Mother Earth and the one God created a realm where the sun never dies, but only rests. The true Terdange, where Eloa walks smiling, naked feet treading upon the soil, and green things grow in his wake. So it may be. I can only believe and trust that it was true. Our journey was but a day's, and even that met its end. It came, as such things ever do, when we believed that we had passed the point of crisis, and our way lay clear before us. No one knows, for a surety, how far the reach of the Master of the Straits extends. Without a doubt, it was farther than Quintilius Raus reckoned, for it came when he began at last to relax, swaying comfortably at the wheel of his mighty ship, ordering his sailors to take the surroundings, and gauging whether or not it was time to turn his prow toward the north. It began as a wind ruffling the waves. Such a thing, one might think, is normal at sea, where the wind is one's mistress and dictates one's course. This is true. But this wind, I cannot explain. It ran contrary to the westerly breeze that blew us true, lower than that wind, blowing the waves backward, creating a cauldron of distress. "Ah, no!" Quintilius Raus breathed, taking a firmer grip upon the wheel and casting his gaze skyward. "Ah, no, elder brother, have mercy!" I looked up then at the sky, which had bid fair for our journey, as clear as the day before. No longer. Clouds roiled above us, gathering with purpose and darkness, a roiling mix blotting out the sun. "What is it?" I asked the Queen's Admiral, dreading the answer. Questions are dangerous, for they have answers. I had said as much to the Duke de Morbihan. Quintilius Raus looked at me with fear in his bright blue eyes, the old trawler-line scar dragging down one side of his mouth. "It is him," he said. And that is when the skies opened upon us. For those who have never survived a storm at sea, I do not wish it upon anyone. Our ship, which had seemed such a safe haven on the vast breast of the waters, was pitched and tossed about like a child's toy. The contrary winds, one moment ago a mild phenomenon, turned to forces of destruction, boiling the sea into crests and troughs higher than our tallest mast. Night or day, there was no telling. The skies turned a horrid bruised colour, split only by lightning.
"Drop sails!"
Quintilius Rouse shouted, his powerful voice battered and lost in the winds and the lashing rain that followed.
Drop sails!
Somehow his men heard. I saw them as I clung helplessly to the foremast, their silhouettes against the lightning-struck sky high overhead, obeying the admiral's orders. The sails dropped like stones, and I saw one man at least swept over as the ship listed to starboard. Rain blew like veils across my sight. Through it, incredibly, I saw Jocelyn making his way to the foredeck, from grip to grip, a dim figure inching along with sheer determination. I prayed Hyacinth had gained the safety of our cabin, though I doubted it. I remembered him last amid a group of sailors, too interested to go below, and it had come upon us too fast. Gaining the mast, Jocelyn took hold and crouched over me, sheltering me with his body from the buffeting winds. Drenched and sodden, I peered out from under him, my own rain-lashed hair obscuring my vision.
"Do we turn back?"
Jocelyn asked the Admiral, shouting the question.
"My Lord Admiral, do we turn back?"
"Here he comes!"
Quintilius Rouse roared his answer, pointing with one shaking finger across the water. He came. The Master of the Straits. Those who have not made this passage say I lie. I swear it is true. Huddled under Jocelyn's sheltering form, I saw him, a face upon the waters, moving toward us. Of waves was his flesh wrought, of thunderclouds his hair, lightning his eyes, and I swear he spoke. His voice burst upon us like thunder, drumming at our ears, until we could but cower beneath it.
"Who dares cross?"
Like calls to like. Lashing himself to the wheel, the Queen's Admiral dared to reply, roaring like fury into the winds, shaking his fist.
"I do, you old bastard! And if you want your precious black boar to rule in Alba, you'll let me go!"
There was laughter then, and the face of the waters reared up three times the height of our midmast, dwarfing Rouse's defiance. A vast, watery face, laughing like thunder, until I clapped my hands over my drowning ears.
"That is not your dream, seafarer. What toll will you pay?"
"Name your price,"
Quintilius Rouse howled his answer, hands clinging like iron to the straining wheel. The ship plunged into a trough. He held its course, hurling defiance into the winds.
"Just name it, you old bastard. I'll pay what it takes."
The ship climbed up the crest of a wave toward the vast moor, dark and infinite, that had opened in the sky. Open, laughing like thunder, to swallow us forevermore. "This is the end," I thought, closing my eyes, and felt the absence of Jocelyn's sheltering body.
"A song!"
I knew the voice. It was Jocelyn's, strident and urgent with hope. His hand grabbed at my shoulder, hauling me erect, even as the ship teetered atop the pitch of a wave.
"Such as you have never heard, my Lord of the Straits, sung upon the waters!"
He shouted at the wave-wrought face that loomed over us.
"A song!"
"What song?" I asked Jocelyn desperately, the ship pitching. The rain whipped his hair, dull and sodden, his hands anchoring me. We might have been the last two mortals left alive, for all that I could see. "Jocelyn, what song?" He answered, shouting. I saw it, though I could not hear. The wind ripped his answer away, rendered it soundless. But we had been together through all that humans might endure, through blizzard and storm, and all that the elements might hurl at us. We did not need to speak aloud. I saw his lips form the words. "Gunter's Steading." And because there was nothing else to do except die, I sang then a song of Gunter's Steading, a hearth song, one of those the women had taught me, Hedvig and the others, a song of waiting and longing, of a handsome thane dying young, in a welter of blood and sorrow, of reaping and sowing and harvest, of old age come early, and weaving by the fireside, while the snows of winter pile deep at the door. I am not Telesis de Mornay, at whose voice all present fall silent, listening. But I have a gift for language that de Launay taught to me. These songs I had committed to memory, scrawled by burnt twig next to the hearth fire, never recorded by men. They were the homely songs of scaldy women, to which no scholar ever paid heed. And I sang them then, though the wind tore the words from my lips, for the master of the straits, whose face moved over the waters, impossibly vast and terrible. And he listened, and the waters grew calm, the awesome features sinking back into the rippling waves. No one ever had brought these songs to the sea before. I kept singing, while the seas grew tranquil and the waves lapped at the sides of the ship, and Jocelyn's hand was beneath my arm, keeping me upright, while my voice grew ragged. Those sailors quailing beneath the onslaught stirred, creeping onto deck. I sang, hoarsely, of children born and fir trees giving forth new growth, until Quintilius Rouse roused himself with a shake.
"Do you accept our toll?" he cried.
The waves themselves shuddered, a face forming on their surface, benign and complacent, yet vast, so vast, its mouth could have swallowed our ship whole.
"Yes," came the reply, whispered and dreadful. "You may pass."
And it was gone. The withdrawal of resistance came like a blow, the restoration of calm water dissipating into mere waves, rippled by a western breeze. The skies cleared. It was not even dusk. I drew in a great breath, my throat rasping.
"Is it done?"
I asked Quintilius Rouse hoarsely, trusting to Jocelyn to keep me upright.
"It is done," he confirmed,
his blue eyes darting left and right, scarce trusting to the evidence they saw. He looked at me then with something like fear.
"Did de Launay teach you that, then, to soothe elder brother's craving?"
I laughed at that, my voice cracking with exhaustion and hysteria.
"No," I whispered, leaning on Jocelyn's man-braced arm. "Those are the songs of scaldy women, whose husbands and brothers may yet slaughter us all."
And with that, I collapsed. When I awoke, I was lying in a dark cabin, enmeshed in a hammock, as if in a hempen cradle, swaying. A single lamp lit the darkness, its flame trimmed low. A familiar figure drowsed beside it, sitting in a chair.
"Hyacinth," I whispered.
He started and lifted his head, white grin reassuring.
"Did you think you'd lost me?"
"I wasn't sure."
I struggled to sit upright, then gave up, resigning myself to the hammock.
"I saw at least one go over."
"Four,"
he said it quietly, no longer smiling. "It would have been more, if not for Jean Marchand. He made us lash ourselves to whatever we could."
"You saw it then?"
My voice was hoarse still. "It is something to sing down the sea." Hyacinth nodded, a faint movement in the shadows.
"I saw it."
"Where's Jocelyn?"
"Above,"
Hyacinth yawned. "He wanted to see the stars, to gain his bearings. He's not vomiting any more, at least." I began to laugh, then stopped. It hurt my throat.
"We owe him our lives."
"You sang?" He looked at me curiously through the darkness.
"He made me." He remembered the songs. Gunter's Steading.
I lay back, exhausted again.
I never thought I'd be grateful to the Scaldi.
"All knowledge is worth having," Hyacinth said, quoting de Launay, whom I had quoted to him. "Even this, even the Dromond." Rising, he smoothed my hair back from my brow and kissed me.
"Go to sleep," he said, and blew out the lamp.
Chapter 68. The following day dawned as calm and bright as one might wish, as if in apology for the master of the strait's dreadful storm. We had turned northward in the night, rounding below a tip of Alba, and I could see her green coastline lying off our starboard bow, hazy in the distance. "Where do we make landfall?" I asked Quintilius Rouse, standing on deck with him. The wind tugged at my cloak, but it seemed milder than yesterday, with less of a biting chill. I felt more myself, and thanked Blessed Eloah for the thousandth time that I healed quickly.
"That," the Admiral said dryly, "is a very good question."
He looked haggard and tired, having gotten but a few hours' sleep, delegating the wheel to his helmsman once he'd determined we were well and truly clear of danger. He swept one brawny arm toward the coast.
"There in all its glory lies Alba. Where Isandra's deposed Cruach bides is another matter."
"I thought you knew," I said, dismayed once more. "You sought him before, you said, among the Dalriada."
"I know where the Dalriada lie."
Rouse turned to spit, then remembered my presence and refrained.
"On the land that juts out nearest to Aera. Our sources said that's where Drustan Mab Nectna fled, but it's a sizable kingdom."
"How do we even know it's true?"
Rouse shrugged. "Delaunay said it was, and Telesis de Mornay. They had some system of exchange across the waters with Alban loyalists, folk that Telesis had known during her exile. Then the messages stopped coming, and they reckoned Mailcon, the usurper, caught them. That's when I tried the coast, but I never caught sight of any Pictish prince."
And I had doubted when he called it a fool's errand. I sat down on a spar near his feet, thinking. In the prow, Jocelyn was doing his castling exercises, silhouetted against the sky. Sunlight flashed from his steel. He had found his sea legs, it seemed. "How long until we reach the kingdom of the Dalriada?" I asked.
"A day, no more," Quintilius Rouse shrugged again. "Then we take our chances, I reckon, and hope they can lead us to the Cruinia."
I was not entirely sure I liked his plan. I'd doubts enough about my own skill with the tongue. It is one thing to learn a language on paper, with tutors who speak one's own language, and another to deal with native speakers. And I wasn't sure that Dalriada spoke the same Cruinia I had learned. Aera is its own island, and separate from Alba. If their folk had established a foothold on Alba, would they speak a dialect I recognized, or somewhat altogether different? The scholars do not say, for the armies of Tiberium never ventured so far before being ousted by Kinnel Rhu. And if it were so, how could I make them understand? Isandra's ring, Drustan Mab Nectina's pledge, would mean naught to them. So I mulled over the problem, until it came together in my mind. All knowledge is worth having. "Hyacinth," I said. "Mayhap he can help. He can speak the Dromond and tell us where to land."
"You believe it?"
Quintilius Rouse glanced at me sidelong, profound doubt in his blue gaze.
"It's enough that we come in a single ship, I think. Even Delaunay wasn't so credible, lass, and he could ferret out truth in the strangest of places."
Resting my chin in my hands, I watched the waves pass. "I know, but my Lord Admiral, when I was but 13, his mother spoke the Dromond for me, unbidden, while I was trying to get at the truth of Delaunay's history. She told me I would rue the day I learned it."
"And you did, I suppose," Rouse said gruffly, when I ventured no more.
"There were 2 days." It was hypnotic, watching the sliding waves, unchanging, never the same. I learned half of it the day Melisande Sharazai contracted me for the longest night, and used me to flush out your messenger, my lord, whose liege led Deglamore's men to Delaunay. I learned that he had been beloved of Prince Roland, and I learned the balance of it the day he was killed, and all of the household with him, including Alcuin, who was like a brother to me. That was the day I learned that he was oath-sworn to protect Isandra de la Courcelle, which Alcuin told us, dying. Yes, my lord, I rue those days. Quintilius Rouse was silent for a moment, tending to the wheel.
"Anyone could say as much," he said finally. "'Tis dangerous to chase after buried secrets."
"It is," I agreed, but she spoke the Drummond twice. The second time, she said, "Do not discount the Culloch Gorim." "Do you know what that means, my lord?" Rouse paused, then shook his head, ruddy locks fraying in the wind. "Neither did she," I said. "It means the Black Boar in Cruinia. And there is no reason at all, my lord, why she should have known those words or linked them to me." I rose, stretching out my joints. "When we are in sight of the kingdom of Dalriada, then, will you let Hyacinth speak?"
"Those were his mother's words." Quintilius Rouse's voice was rough, though I could see he believed a little.
No one could pass the Master of the Straits and not come to believe in things unseen.
"Did the lad ever speak you true?"
"Not me," I answered truthfully. "He fears it to speak for friends. But he spoke it for Melisande once."
"What did he tell her?"
The Admiral's hands lay slack on the wheel, caught up despite himself. All sailors love a good tale, I have learned. He looked at me with sharp curiosity. "That which yields," I said, feeling a chill despite the mild wind and hugging my elbows, "is not always weak."
I walked away then, close wrapped in my velvet cloak, salt-stained now, a gift of the Duke de Morbihan, feeling Rouse's sharp gaze still at my back.
An easy enough prophecy, a sceptic might say, but not if one is that which yields.
I made my way across the wooden decks, polished to a high gleam. Quintilius Rouse aided no idle hands on his ship, to find Hyacinth trying his luck at fishing. He glanced up at me, boasting.
"Phaedra, look! 3-1 I've caught!"
He dangled a string of fish at me, bright silvery bodies jerking and twisting, drowning in dry air.
"We had a wager, Remy and I," he added,
nodding toward the sailor beside him, who looked more amused than not.
"Very nice."
I inspected his fish cursorily. "Hyacinth, if I asked you to see where the long road we travel touches land once more, could you do it?"
His black eyes gleamed wickedly in the sunlight, and he grasped the largest of the fish, offering it to me with both hands. "For you, O Star of the Evening, anything. Are you sure you don't want to ask your Castellan? He may be jealous of such bounty."
I laughed, despite myself. "I'll risk it." For a day and another night, then, we made our way up the coast of Alba, tacking against the slow winds. Our third day broke misty and strange, becalming us, until even the Courcelle pennant hung limp from the tallest mast. Rouse set his men to oars then, cursing them, and we moved torturously slow, the green coast appearing and receding out of the mists.
"Now, if ever,"
Quintilius Rouse said grimly, calling me on deck.
"Bring on the Tsingano, lad, Phaedra O'Delaunay. Let him point the way."
There was no mockery in Hyacinth now. He walked slowly to the prow of the ship, his face raised to the mists that held us thick clasped. His head turned from side to side, like a hunting dog casting about for a scent, sight-blinded, all his senses elsewhere. The sailors watched him closely, having decided he was lucky. No few had had the ill fortune of dicing with him, I learned later, and Quintilius Rouse, in all his doubt, held his breath.
"I cannot see it," Hyacinth whispered, arms blundering outward in the thick mists. "Phaedra, I cannot see our road."
I went to him then. They left us alone, muttering. Jocelyn watched silently, offering no comment.
"You can, Hyacinth, I know you can," I said, taking his arm. "It's only mist. What's that to the veils of what might be?"
"It is Vrajna," he shivered, cold beneath my grasp. "They were right. Manoj was right. This is no business for men."
Waves lapped at the sides of our ship, little waves moving us nowhere. We were becalmed.
The rowers had paused.
"Prince of Travellers," I said, "the long road will lead us home. Let it show the way."
Hyacinth shivered again, his black gaze blurred and fearful.
"No, you don't understand. The long road goes on and on. There is no home for us, only the journey."
"You are half d'Angeline,"
I raised my voice, unintending, shaking him. "Hyacinth, Ella was blood in your veins to ground you home, and Tsingani to show the way. You can see it. You have to. Where is the Kulluk Gorim?"
His head turned this way and that, dampness beading on his black ringlets.
"I cannot see it," he repeated, shuddering. "It is Rajna. They were right. I should never have looked, never. Men were not meant to part the veils. Now this mist is sent to veil us all for my sin."
I stood there, my fingers digging into his arm, and cast my gaze about. Up, upward, where the sun rode faint above the mists, a white disk. The ship's three masts rose, bobbing, to disappear in greyness.
"If you cannot see through it," I said fiercely, "then see over it."
Hyacinth looked at me slowly, then up at the tallest mast, the crow's nest lost in the mists.
"Up there?" he asked, his voice full of fear. "You want me to look from up there?"
"Your great-grandmother," I said deliberately, "gave me a riddle. What did Anastasia see through the veils of time to teach her son the Dromond? A horse-drawn wagon and a seat by the Kumpania's fire, or a mist-locked ship carrying a ring for a queen's betrothed? It is yours to answer." He looked for a long time without speaking, and then he began to climb. For unaccountable minutes we were all bound in mist-wreathed silence, staring into the greyness where Hyacinth had disappeared far overhead. The ship rocked gently, muffled waves lapping. Then his voice came, faint and disembodied, a single lonely cry.
"There!"
It might have been the depths of the ocean he pointed to, for all any of us could see. Quintilius Rouse cursed, fumbling his way back toward the helm.
"Get a relay!" he roared, setting his sailors to jumping. "You, and you," he pointed, "move! Get up that rigging! Martian, call the beat. Get the oarsmen to put their backs to it. We follow the Tsingano's heading."
All at once the ship was scrambling into motion, men hurrying hither and thither, carrying out Rouse's orders.
2 points to port," the call came, shouted down the rigging. "And a light in the prow, Admiral."
The mighty ship turned slowly, nosing through the mist. Far forward, a lantern kindled, a single sailor holding it aloft at the very prow. Down came the shouted orders, and Rouse at the helm jostled the ship into position, until the lantern was aligned with Hyacinth's pointing finger, high in the crow's nest, unseen by those of us below.
"That's it, lads," he cried. "Now, row! Out oars!"
Below decks, the steady beat of a drum sounded, Jean Marchand's voice rising in counterpoint. 2 rows of oars pulled in unison, digging into the sea. The ship began to move forward, gaining speed, travelling blind through the mists. I did not need to be a sailor to guess how dangerous it was, so close to a strange, unseen coast. I joined Jocelyn, and we stood together, watching Quintilius Rouse man the helm, his scarred face alight with reckless desperation, having cast his lot. How long we sailed thusly, I cannot say. It seemed the better part of a day, though I think it was no more than an hour. Then came another cry, and a change of direction. On Hyacinth's lead, we turned our prow toward land, invisible before us, but the last time we glimpsed close by. The Admiral's face grew grim as he held the course, white-knuckled. For the first time all day, a wind arose, sudden and unexpected, filling our sails. The rowers put up their oars, resting, as we raced before the wind like a bird on the wing. out of the mists and into sunlight, gleaming on the waters, heading straight into a narrow rocky bay that cut deep into the shoreline. A great cheer arose, dwarfing in sound the one that they'd given when first we set sail. High overhead, Hyacinth clutched the railing of the crow's nest, weak with his efforts. Before us lay landfall, a stony beach with green hills leading down to it, a bright silver river snaking through the green. And on the beach, what looked suspiciously like a reception party, fully armed and awaiting us. Chapter 69.
Drop anchor!
Quintilius Rouse's roar split the sudden brightness as sails were lowered and lashed with alacrity. The rowers dug in the oars, the ship slowing in the backwash of water they churned. Hyacinth descended the rigging on shaking legs. With a mighty clang, the anchor was loosed, enormous links of chain rattling through the winch. The ship came to anchor in the deep waters of the bay, broadside to the shore, the Courcelle Swan fluttering from her mast. Quintilius Rouse muttered under his breath, reaching into his purse. A gold coin he drew out, tossing it overboard in a high arc. It glittered in the sun and fell with a splash. It is a sailor's superstition to pay tribute to the Lord of the Deep after a dangerous journey. And then all of us found places along the length of the ship, staring landward. It was a small enough party, no more than a dozen men in bright woolen plaids. But they waved broadswords in the air, no mistake, sun flashing off steel.
"What do you make of that?"
Rouse asked, pointing and squinting. I followed his line of sight. Two figures in the forefront, smaller than the others. The larger was still, unlike the others, dark-haired. The smallest leaped about, brandishing a spear, gauging the weapon against the size of the men's swords. "A child?" I said. "My Lord Admiral, two, perhaps?" His reddish brows drew down in a scowl.
"You're the Queen's emissary. What do we do?"
I gathered my cloak around me, clutching briefly at Isandra's ring. "We go to meet them," I said firmly. "Bring six men, my lord, skilled at arms. I will take Hyacinth and Jocelyn."
"We'll be outnumbered," he said bleakly.
"It will show faith." I glanced wryly at Jocelyn, gazing shoreward with keen interest, vambraces glinting as he leaned on the rail. "If it is a trap, my lord, all your men would not suffice. If it is not, we will not be outnumbered, not with one trained by the Castellans on guard. And, my lord, if you can spare it, somewhat to offer the Dalriada from your hoard. The queen will recompense your loss."
"So be it."
Quintilius Rouse made his selections, Hyacinth's fishing companion Remy among them, and gave orders, giving the helm over to Jean Marchand. He went into his cabin, returning with a coffer he showed to me, filled with silks and gems and vessels of spice. I nodded approval, as if I had knowledge of such things. And then one of the oar-boats was lowered, the rope ladder descended, and I found myself handed down into the boat. Rouse's six sailors set to at the oars, and we began moving through the shining waves, each stroke bringing us closer to shore, farther from the safety of the ship and all things d'Angeline. I held my head high, doing my best to look as if I knew what I was doing. At some 30 yards they came clear. The men were warriors, and no mistake, fair-haired and ruddy, reminding me uneasily of the Scaldi. Tall and thewed as they were. But I'd been right. One was a child, a young boy with red-gold hair and a gold torque about his neck, jumping up and down in his eagerness and shouting in an unintelligible tongue. And the other. She was no child, but a young woman, slim and self-possessed, with black hair and nut-brown skin, and there was a little space around her, where the Dalriada warriors gave way. "Be welcome," she said clearly, as we drew in earshot, her voice giving tongue to the words in Cruinia, fluid and musical. She held out one hand,
and Vidalriada men waved their swords, shouting. Then sheathed them, surging forward, wading heedless into the sea, to grasp the sides of our oar-boat, hauling us through the shallows unto the rocky shore. The boy raced back and forth, waving his toy spear.
"Be welcome," the young woman repeated. No more than a girl, really, with twin lines of blue dots etched along her brown cheekbones. Her dark eyes smiled, her hand still extended.
The Dangelines sat stock still in the boat, beached and no longer rocking on water. With a slight shock, I realized that I, and I alone, knew what she had said. I rose, taking care not to tilt the boat.
"I am Fedra Nodelone,"
I said carefully in Cruinia, taking pains to mimic her inflections, "and I come as ambassador from Isandra de la Courcelle, the Queen of Terre d'Ange. We seek Drustin Mab Nectina, the true Cruach of Alba." The warriors yelled at the sound of Drustin's name, rattling their swords and stamping. The young boy shouted. The girl smiled again, laying her hands on his shoulders and stilling him.
"I am Maraith, his sister," she said simply. "We have been waiting for you."
"How?" I whispered, then remembered, turning to the others.
"It's all right," I said in Dangeline. "They are giving us welcome."
Strong hands extended, helping me out of the boat. I nearly staggered to catch my footing on solid land.
Moraith's smile deepened, and she came forward to take my shoulders in her hands, looking into my eyes. Hers were wide-set and very dark, seeming even wider with the blue dots on her cheeks.
"I had a dream," she said calmly. "Brennan played on the beach, and a swan flew overhead. He threw his spear and pierced its eye. The swan fell to earth and took off its skin of feathers. It plucked out the spear and spoke. So I followed Brennan to see where he shook his spear at the gulls. When I found out, Aemon's men came. We waited, and here you are."
I shuddered under her hands. "You followed a dream?"
Her dark eyes moved over our party, came to rest on Hyacinth's face.
"You followed a dream," she said, and left me to go to him, touching his face with slim brown fingers. "A waking dreamer."
He started back at the touch with a strange expression. Rouse's men and Vidalriada stared at each other and fingered weapons gaugingly. The boy Brennan tilted his head up at Maraith and asked something. I could almost pick out words in what he said, almost.
"May we meet your brother?" I asked Maraith, desperate to make sense of the encounter.
"Of course," she turned back to me, still smiling. "But you must meet the twins first. They are the lords of the Dalriada."
It was a strange procession. Two of Rouse's men remained behind with the boat to relay what had happened shipboard. The rest of us followed, as we wended our way along a narrow track through the green hills. The Dalriada were laughing and shouting, one of them taking the boy Brennan on his shoulders, playing at being a horse. The Dangelines were silent and wide-eyed. I did my best to explain, with scant idea myself, what had befallen us. The seat of the Dalriada royalty is a great hall, set atop one of the highest hills. It echoes the hall of Tir Mior in Eire, I am told, where the High King of Eire rules. A stone building, filled with daub and whitewashed with lime, the roof thatch. But that is not to do it justice. It is vast, with seven doors, through which one enters according to rank. They have laws governing such things, the Aerons do. We entered through the sun door, which was an honour, although I did not know it then. It is the second highest rank they could have accorded us, the highest being the door of the White Mare, through which only the scions of Tir Mior may enter. There we were made to wait in a sitting room, while Brennan was sent scuttling on an errand, and Vidalriada warriors lounged about in bright-eyed poses. Beyond the next door, we heard sounds of quarrelling.
"You speak for the Swan," Mraith said to me nonplussed. "Who stands with you?"
"He does," I said without hesitation, pointing to Quintilius Rouse, who held the treasure coffer. And he," I indicated Jocelyn and Hyacinth, who both bowed uneasily.
"That is well," she said, and disappeared. After a moment she returned. "The twins will see you."
I looked once at Quintilius Rouse, once at Jocelyn, and once at Hyacinth, drawing strength from their steady regard. Taking a deep breath, I followed Mraith into the Hall of the Lords of the Dalriada. I don't know what I had expected. It had all occurred with such speed. But if it was anything, it was not this. The two of them, brother and sister, on their adjoining thrones. Now I know them well enough, the twins. Then I took refuge in what I knew best, taking the coffer from Rouse and offering it to them, then kneeling with bowed head. Grania looked at me keenly, I saw through lowered lashes, toying restlessly with the gold talk about her neck and the jeweled pins scattered in her red-gold tresses. Eamon was the more suspicious, setting the coffer aside and raising his voice in a sharp query.
"They have come to see Drustin," Mraith said, and I understood the Aaron words, picking them out one by one in her liquid accent, piecing them together after she had spoken. "They seek audience with the Cruach."
Eamon frowned, but Grania stood up, her grey-green eyes alight. She was a tall woman, and striking by their standards. Her features were cruder than ours, but her hair and her eyes were quite lovely, and her generous mouth that smiled at us. She wore a sword at her waist, and I gauged her to be not much older than Jocelyn, in her late 20s, no more.
"Tell them they are welcome," she said, "and fetch your brother."
"My lady," I said haltingly, lifting my head, the half-familiar words twisting my tongue. "I understand, I think." She gave me her sharp gaze, red-gold brows arching. Eamon muttered on his throne. I caught only a word of it. Trouble. He was tall like his sister, but his hair had a paler hue, his eyes a muddier tinge. "So that is how it is," I thought. To the others I said in Dangeline, "They are sending for the Cruach." We heard him before we saw him, a halting gait among other steps. I had forgotten that. I heard Delaunay's voice in my memory, light and amused.
"And Isandre de la Courcelle, flower of the realm, shall teach a club-foot barbarian prince to dance the gavotte."
Drustin Mab Nectaner, prince of the Picti, the deposed Cruach of Alba, entered the hall. He had with him an older woman and two younger, as well as Mraith, who could only be his mother and sisters, and a handful of warriors as well. They were cut from the same cloth, all of them, slender and dark, a hand's breadth shorter at least than the twins. But Delaunay trained me to observe, and I noted well how the Dalriada fell back, creating a space for the Picti. Truly he bore their sign, in blue-woad mark, bisecting his brow, swirling on his cheeks, outlandish and barbarian. But it was not entirely displeasing, and his eyes gazed out through Pictish warrior's mask, fine and dark. A cloak of combed red wool hung from his shoulders, clasped with gold.
"You are the Swan's voice,"
he said to me in Cruinia, those dark eyes cutting me through to the bone.
"What does she say?"
If he had not spoken, he was strange enough and fearful, but I might have doubted my answer. But there was somewhat in his voice, a slight break, hopeful and young, that only one trained to listen would hear. I rose to my feet, lifting the chain from about my neck, holding forth Roland's gold signet ring. It swayed between us.
"My lord," I said, raising my voice, "Isandre de la Courcelle, the Queen of Terre d'Ange, would honour the covenant between you."
Drustin Mab Nectaner took the ring, closing his hand hard about it. He glanced at his mother and his three sisters, who nodded all in unison. A gleam flared and died in his dark eyes.
"What is the price?" he asked me harshly. I met his dark gaze, staring out from his blue-marked face that had seen loss and betrayal, his father's murder. For a moment we understood each other, the Pictish prince and I. "Terre d'Ange stands under threat of invasion," I said softly. "If you regain the throne of Alba, the Master of the Straits will allow you to cross. That is the price. Your aid to secure the D'Angeline throne. That is the price of wedding the Queen of Terre d'Ange, my lord." Drustin looked at the twins. They shifted on their thrones, the lords of the Dalriada. Gronya leaned forward while Aemon leaned back, not meeting the Cruach's gaze.
"What do you say, my brethren?"
Drustin asked it in Cruinia. His dark eyes gleamed.
"You have waited for a sign, Aemon. Here it is. Let us take up the sword, and Alba will flock to our side. Melkon's men will run before us, and the Master of the Straits will reward us, laying the waters as calm as a carpet. What do you say?"
"I say," Gronya drew a deep breath.
"No,"
Aemon cut her off, tugging at his talk, speaking slowly in Cruinia.
"No."
He shook his head, stubborn as an ox.
"The risk is too great, and the gain too little. Do they bring an army? Do they bring swords?"
He opened the coffer, showing its contents, shimmering and harmless, redolent with spice. Gronya murmured appreciatively, drawing out a length of gold-shot green silk.
"No."
Aemon drew the coffer back, nearly closing the lid on his sister's hand.
"Fair words and baubles." "Dagda Mor,"
Gronya snapped at him, eyes flashing. "You are a coward and a fool. I say..."
"You say what you like,"
he flared back at her, slipping back into Erin.
"Unless we both say it, the Dalriada go nowhere. We are hard put enough to hold this piece of land."
Too much to hope I was hearing wrong. I followed it well enough, looking between them. Rouse, Jocelyn, and Hyacinth watched perplexed as the twins quarrelled.
"Aemon,"
Drustin raised his voice, silencing them.
"You hold this land now because my father chose to honour Cynalru's old promise to the Dalriada, and the folk of the Culloch Gorum will not move against me, no, nor many of the Tarav Cro, even if Melkon commands the Red Bull to war. But what of your children and your children's children?"
"Who will know their father and grandfather for a coward?" Gronya said hotly. "If we do not..."
"Enough!"
Aemon shouted at his sister, clutching his head. He glowered at Drustin.
"Think you that Alban will flock to a cripple's standard, my lord?"
The Cruinia warriors murmured, and one of Drustin's sisters drew a soft breath. His mother touched her arm lightly, bidding her to silence. Drustin Mab Nectina laughed, showing strong white teeth, and held out his arms. The red cloak he wore slipped back, revealing the elaborate whorls of blue that tattooed his bare shoulders, braceleted his arms.
"What do you think, brother? They have done before. On horseback I have 4 strong legs. It is enough."
I could not help but glance at his deformity then, though I'd resisted until that moment. In truth, though he wore boots of soft leather to conceal or protect it, one could see that his right foot twisted at the ankle, and the stunted foot bent upon itself, so that the sole did not rest upon the ground. For all that, his right leg looked as hale as the left, with lean, knotted muscle.
"Will you try my sword and see if I am fit to follow?" Drustin asked softly, and Aemon looked away. "Then you have answered your question, brother."
I took the moment to translate quickly for the D'Angelines, recapping what had transpired. Quintilius Rouse looked unhappy. Jocelyn glanced at Aemon.
"I'll try his steel," he muttered with uncarceline ire. "Let him see how he likes the baubles I carry."
In the pause, the hall had erupted with a great deal of similar talk, the Cruinia and Medalriada shoving and quarrelling. Gronya was in the midst of it, shouting at one of the Picti, her sword half unsheathed. Strange to me to see a woman armed, but she was not the only one of the Dalriada women to bear a sword, only, as I learned later, the mightiest of them.
It is not uncommon among the Picti either, though Nectina and her daughters did not ride to battle. Indeed, they were the only serene figures there, watching the proceedings with four sets of identical wide dark eyes. At length, Aemon stomped down from his throne, shouting, and the melee broke apart, while he and his sister argued until he threw up his hands.
"It is too great a matter to decide on a moment's whim," he announced, saying it in Cruinia for my benefit, glancing at me. "We receive you and your gifts with thanks, Phaedra of Terre d'Ange. Tonight we feast in your honour, and tomorrow we will speak again of such things. Do you agree, my prince?"
Drustin inclined his head, but it was his mother who answered.
"That is wisely spoken, my lord Aemon," Nectina said, in a voice deeper and even more mellifluous than her daughter's.
"Oh, he can speak," Gronya said contemptuously, tossing her red-gold hair, and speak, until the Brehons cover their ears and beg him to cease."
Nectina's mouth twitched as if repressing a smile.
"That is a great gift, child, and no doubt. But we have guests we have granted hospitality, and they are no doubt weary from their journey. Will you not offer them rest and refreshment?"
"Doctor," Gronya looked us over with dismay and interest. "Yes, of course." Clapping her hands, she began to summon serving folk about. Leaving domestic matters to his sister's control, Aemon wrapped his cloak around him and stalked out with his insulted dignity, taking the Dalriada men with him. Prince Drustin gathered his Cruinia, speaking to them in low tones. I caught a little of it. He was urging them to go among the Dalriada and spread the spark of glorious battle.
"Do not fear."
It was a low voice at my side, soothing and musical. I turned to see Nectina and her daughters smiling at me, Moraith the youngest of them.
"They are like an ill-matched team, the twins," Nectina said, nodding at Gronya. "She pulls at the traces while he digs in his heels. But if you can find the balance between them, they are strong in the harness."
"How do I do that?" I asked, pleading.
But she only touched my brow, gazing into my eyes and smiling.
"You will find a way. For this you were chosen."
They turned away then, proceeding with calm from the hall. I turned to my d'Angeline companions, shrugging. "It seems we must find a way to balance the twins," I said wryly. "If anyone has an idea, let me know."
Chapter 70. I was given a room to share with Breatha, the eldest of Drustin's sisters, who would be the mother of his heirs, in the Cruinia manner. Even if he and Isandra wed, her children would never sit the throne of Alba. They would be heirs to the d'Angeline throne instead, half-Pictish scions of Eloa, raised to House Courcel. I will admit, for one born and bred to Terre d'Ange, it was a discomforting thought. "We are the eldest children of Earth on this soil," Breatha announced as if divining my thoughts. Directing a servant-maid to plump the pillows, she gave me a tranquil smile. "Many thousands of years before Yeshua's birth, before he bled on the wooden gallows, before the Magdalene shed tears and Eloa walked the earth, we crossed to Alba. We are the folk of the Culloch Gorham, those who followed the Black Boar to the west before d'Angelines knew to count time upon their fingers. When the others came, tall and fair, the Faller Born, the White Horse of Era, the Tarav Crow of the north, the Eidlach Orr of the south, we were here. The Dalriada were of the White Horse, and Maelcom the Usurper of the Red Bull. Of the Eidlach Orr, the Golden Hind, I knew naught." "And they will follow Drustin?" I asked. "All of them?"
"If the Culloch Gorham wills," she said simply. I was not reassured.
Breatha bent her calm gaze upon me. "All things will be as they will. Do not fear." It was soothing advice, but I'd seen too much to be soothed by the words of a girl no older than I, if as much.
I had seen Duke Isidore de Glamour ride in triumph with the allies of Cymlach, and I knew too well the dangerous intelligence of Voldemar Selig, whose warriors numbered in the tens of thousands, and whose shelves bore texts of the greatest of military tacticians. It had been a long time since Cynalru rallied the Cruinia against the armies of Tiberium, and a pair of quarrelling twins, a tattooed prince and a rabble of undisciplined warriors, did not inspire confidence. They are like children, I thought, who reckon they know danger until they meet it face to face. Then I remembered Moraid's dream and was unsure. Come, Breather cocked her head, listening. They are making ready to feast. Shall we join them? Such was my mood as we proceeded to the hall of the Lords of the Dalriada, as despairing and reckless as Quintilius Rous at the helm, racing through the mist toward unseen shores. If the twins were at odds on their course, they were agreed on their display of hospitality. Full half the ship had been brought to land while we rested, and the hall was crammed with guests, Dangeline, Dalriada, and Cruinia alike, loud and celebratory. It was a strange thing to mark the presence of so many Dangelines among foreigners, honed features shining like cut gems among unpolished stone. They got on well enough, I dare say. Sailors are a garrulous lot, and more used than most to the barriers that language presents. We feasted well, for Alba is a fertile land, and Vidalriada boasted of the wealth of it. Simple fare by Dangeline standards, but in abundance. Venison and fish stew, spring greens, a curded cheese that was surprisingly sweet, pottage and crude wine. There is a drink they make too, ishka, that burns at first with a fiery harshness, but is smooth at the second sip, tasting of peat and herbs. As the night wore on, the ishka flowed freely, and the bards of Dalriada entertained us with long poems that I translated for the Dangelines. They are mighty talkers, the Dalriada. I understood Grania's insult better. Then Quintilius Rous, ruddy with drink, responded with a Dangeline sailor's song, but I blushed to translate. If I was unsure before then, I'd no doubt when it was done. There was no shame among the Dalriada or the Cruinia as regards such things. They clapped their hands and shouted, picking up the chorus. It reminded me a little of the Scaldi, but it was different here. If naught else, I noted that the women were as bold as the men, eyeing the Dangeline sailors with undisguised interest. No few of them left ere the night was over, Rouse's men following where they led with willing grins, or at least those with a taste for women. Dangeline, Dalriada, it mattered naught, for they'd been a long time stranded in Cushith, with no company save each other. When Rouse's song was done, Aemon's champion Carrig, a Dalriada warrior who towered over the others, made a half-jesting challenge to Jocelyn, poking with amusement at his vambraces and gesturing, then clearing a space in the centre of the hall, drawing his sword and waggling it tauntingly. The twins shouted approval, quaffing ishka. Dalriada and Dangeline urged the fight. The Cruinia looked amused. Jocelyn, with considerable forbearance, glanced at me with raised eyebrows. On a whim, I looked to Drustin Mab Nectina. As before, there was understanding between us. I read the query in his dark eyes, so are they grave in his blue-marked features. "Can your man win?" I nodded imperceptibly. His shoulders lifted in a faint shrug, one hand cautioning temperance. I rose to my feet and addressed the twins. "Let it be seen, then, what manner of sword for Dangelines bring, my lords," I said, ishka rendering my tongue fluent. "But let no blood be spilled to stain our quest. Let he who is disarmed surrender with honour." They accepted the terms with cheers, and Jocelyn rose smoothly, bowing with crossed arms. Quintilius Rous made his drunken way to my side.
"The Castlings only fought to defend," he said, slurring his words a little.
I shrugged.
The prefect of the Castellan Brotherhood abjured him. Jocelyn's blade is sworn to Isandra.
Ah!
His eyes gleamed, and we watched.
Carrig swung his sword over his head in a blur, roaring. It descended as he rushed forward, mountain tall.
Jocelyn's daggers flashed free of their sheaths, crossed hilts catching and deflecting the blade. The revelers laughed as he spun gracefully out of the way, and Carrig staggered, gathering himself for a second charge. Steel clanged. The sword slid harmlessly off one vambrace. Jocelyn moved sideways, evasive as water, reversing his grip. With a motion too subtle for the eye to follow, he brought the hilt of one dagger down on Carrig's sword hand, which opened in anguish, while he swept his leg against the back of the Dalriada's knees. It made a considerable clatter, Carrig falling, sword spinning from his grip. By the time he realized he was on the floor, Jocelyn's crossed daggers were at his throat. Aemon's champion yielded with better grace than I'd expected. When Jocelyn bowed and sheathed his daggers, Carrig rose, seizing him in a roaring embrace and pounding his back.
"We've impressed them with that, at least,"
Hyacinth appeared at my elbow, a lopsided grin on his face, black eyes bright with Ishka. Not an ounce of jealousy in his tone. I saw why, clear enough. Moraith stood at his side, calm and smiling. A waking dreamer, indeed. The daughters of Nectina had an interest in him. He swayed a little on his feet, looking at me as if he wondered whether I would bid him stay or go, and not sure which he hoped. We have that, at least. I brushed my hand over his hair. I'd drunk too much or not enough to have it out with him. "Go where you will, Prince of Travellers," I said, with scarce impaired dignity, or so I thought. "I'm about the Queen's business." His eyes gleamed, and he made a bow, disappearing with Moraith. I looked back. Jocelyn was firmly ensconced among the Dalriada warriors, hardly displeased by their lording, laughing and struggling for words as he attempted to explain the Castellan discipline. Quintilius Rouse had vanished. In his place were three young Dalriada men, falling over each other and shoving to offer me another mug of Ishka. To those who have never served, untrained as a royal ambassador, I offer this advice. Be wary of strange drink. Unfortunately, I had not the benefit of such wisdom. Parts of that night run together in my memory. Others, alas, stand out clear. I remember Aemon wading into the fray, shoving his men aside to offer me a seat, and Ishka, and somewhat else. I remember Grania quarrelling with him, red gold hair like a mantle on her shoulders, eyes sharp with amusement. They squabbled like children, the twins. I remember that. They squabbled over me. I must have said somewhat at some point, what I do not know, but I acceded to one of them, or both. That was what set them to arguing, though they needed little excuse. "Everyone is prettier than you, Aemon," I remember Grania laughing. "I should know what it's like for a change. Isn't that what Dangelines do?" She looked at me for an answer. I must have said yes. It is true enough, after all. Aemon said something surly, which I do not recall, and Grania looked mockingly at him. "Anyway, it is for the guest to choose." So I did. In the morning I woke with a splitting head. "Are they all like that, Dangelines? Taught to do so?" The words were spoken in Erin, which had seemed perfectly comprehensible to me the night before. Now I had to grope at the meaning, puzzling out the dialect as I struggled to collect myself from the rumpled sheets and deal with one of the lords of the Dalriada, already fully awake, alert, and clothed. "No, my lady," I said in reserved Cruinia, pushing my hair back to meet her curious regard. "Not all." "Pity," she said mildly, tying her kirtle. A small figure raced into the room and leapt onto the bed, burrowing amid the coverings. The boy Brennan, who I had guessed by now was her son. I winced, my head pounding. "Go gently," Grania said indulgently to him. She sat on the edge of the bed, ruffling his red-gold hair, gazing amused at me. I'm not sure I like it, to know someone better than I at such things. You serve to remind me, though, that some things are best done in leisure, not haste. Is it how you are trained to acknowledge royalty? I would have laughed if my head hadn't ached so. Brennan squirmed out from under his mother's hand and wormed behind me, small fingers tracing the mark up my spine with a child's curiosity. No, my lady, I said again, pressing fingertips to my temples. It is what I am trained to do. I thought ruefully of the night, of the further wedge I'd driven between the quarrelling twins. I'm not fit for diplomacy. I told the Queen as much. You're adept at tongues. One corner of Grania's mouth curled in a smile. She rose to regard herself in a small mirror, thrusting a jeweled pin in her glorious hair. Anyway, I've given you the key to Aemon. My lady? The child's poking was distracting me from my headache, but I failed to understand. He could never bear for me to have aught that he lacked, Grania said complacently. A horse, a sword, a brooch, whatever it was, Aemon must have as much or finer. You say he will go to war for me? Her look was kindly condescending. Left to choose, Aemon will not decide, neither yea nor nay, until Macca's bull gives milk. For you alone, no. But it will gall him to be denied what I